Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on Friday, the 25th of July of the year 2014. Jeff Bowe with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll be talking to Bill Nicholson about next week's folk music camp. We'll talk to Jim Smart about, from the State Historical Library about the new exhibit of photographs of Seikei Kayamori. We'll also find out about what's happening in the musical menu tonight at the Food Truck Friday with guests Happy Flores and also Carl Reese, who could be here. At Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music and more today on a Juneau afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Representatives of tribes, government, environmental, and industry groups are meeting in the Alaska Native village of Alakakit to discuss a proposed road project. As Dan Bross reports from KUAC in Fairbanks, Native people are concerned about impacts on subsistence.
The state wants to build a 200-mile-long road into remote country in northern Alaska. The road would cross a mix of state, federal, and native lands to provide industrial access to mineral resources. Village of Alakakit Second Chief P.J. Simon says the project has generated concern about effects on fish and caribou.
Disrupt the flora and fauna of the Southern Brooks Range, which I feel is the lungs of the planet, the boreal forest.
Simon says area villagers are also worried about the state spending money on a road during tight budgetary times. But Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority spokesman Karsten Rodvik says that's not an issue.
The cost for the road development and maintenance would be paid by tolls.
Rodvik says the road to proven copper, zinc, lead, and gold prospects would mean jobs and potentially cheaper access to fuel and other goods for currently isolated communities. He says state representatives have come to Alakakit to listen and answer questions. For National Native News in Fairbanks, Alaska, I'm Dan Bross.
Federal government agencies say they're trying to coordinate better with tribal governments to combat climate change. Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington, D.C.
Indian country is vast and diverse, and that makes it hard for the federal government to know what's happening on the ground. Whether it comes to mitigating the risks associated with the changing climate or taking efforts to cut pollution, Joanne Chase, the director of the EPA's American Indian Environmental Office, says it needs to be a partnership.
And we also put our plans out for tribal consultation to ensure that as many tribal voices as possible were able to participate and to be heard.
Chase says tribal leaders aren't shy, and federal government officials are learning how to work together better.
They're continuing to hold our feet to the fire, but nonetheless persistent, and always we're learning how we can do a better job and take that input to heart.
Tribal leaders say this administration is better at collaborating than previous administrations, but they say more work still needs to be done. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Funeral services were held this week for the founder of the first women's shelter on a South Dakota reservation. Tilly Black Bear started the White Buffalo Calf Women's Society on Rosebud and was known for her work nationally. Charles Michael Ray reports.
Tilly Black Bear began her work to increase rights and protections for women in 1978 while testifying to a federal commission about violence against Native women. Those who knew Black Bear say she spent the rest of her life as a tireless advocate for Native women's rights. Shirley Earhart has worked to end domestic violence for more than 30 years. She now works at the Pretty Bird Woman House on Standing Rock. Earhart says Black Bear was a huge influence on the whole movement.
She just didn't slow down. Tilly was our mentor. As we were learning the work and learning how to approach the work, we went to Tilly.
Earhart plans to pass on the lessons she learned from Black Bear to future generations.
Each crisis line call I take, each woman I meet within a shelter somewhere, to remember I'm not the expert. They are the expert because they're living it, and we need to always remember to hear their voices.
Black Bear ran the White Buffalo Calf Woman Society until 2010. In 2011, she was indicted by a federal grand jury on charges of fraud. She pled not guilty, and the case ended in a plea agreement. Despite this, Black Bear is still championed by many who knew her for her lifelong achievements. For National Native News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
This week, the Environmental Protection Agency announced it awarded more than $900,000 to the University of Tulsa to study methods to improve indoor air quality. Information from three tribes will be used. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05 and you are tuned to KTRO News in Juneau. We, like many other residents of Juneau, are down because of the ACS is down as far as the internet is concerned due to the earthquake that happened this morning and the aftershocks. We'll have it back up as soon as we get from ACS. On the phone with me now is Bill Nicholson, who's working with a bunch of people to bring folk music to people in Bush, Alaska. Bill, thank you for being on the show with me today.
Hey, Jeff, great to talk to you.
So the name of your organization is called Dancing with the Spirit. Can you tell everybody about it, please?
Yeah, it's, I think one of the things that happens is kids in Juneau are so lucky because there's so many music programs. But out in the villages, native villages all over Alaska, unless there's a teacher that's particularly good at music, they don't have it. And so, anyway, our program is designed to bring we take guitars and fiddles for a week at a time out to schools, and we've mostly been in the Athabascan region in interior Alaska. We did make it to Yakutat and a couple places, Chiniga, Nuiqsut, and the North Slope. But we've been to 27 villages, most of them many times, just getting the kids going and music and bringing guitars and fiddles as a way to prevent drugs and alcohol and suicide and, just give kids something fantastic to do.
What have you noticed as far as how music affects people in Bush, Alaska when they're able to learn how to play an instrument?
Well, it's kind of like if you hand somebody a guitar, one of the elders in Huslia was saying, Hudson Sam, he said, this can be your best friend. So if you're sad or you're happy or you want to share something or play for a community potluck or dance or something, you've got a great gift, and it makes you feel good because, it just brings such happiness and joy to all these communities.
How did the organization get started?
Well, a long time ago I was in Galena. Over maybe 25 years ago, with the 4-H program. And I was, after the fisheries workshop, I went over to some elder's house and we were playing music. And afterwards when we were having tea, I said, well, how are things in Galena? And they just told me how sad they were with the suicides that are happening. And I just thought, what could I do to help? And it was, later when I started noticing the impact music makes on kids. And as a 4-H agent, I knew 4-H did camps. So I started a camp I'd heard of one in Anchorage, and I started one in Cordova, Alaska. And this was our 20th year. And I also taught at Floyd Dryden about 10 years ago and did a music, bluegrass music club after school there. And, I could just see how great it was for the kids.
You're well known, especially among fans of folk music and the folk festival here, for helping start the careers of musicians like the Barefoot Bluegrass Band.
Yeah, that band started because these camps, you can't believe that just a week or even a few days, these are easy instruments to get started. You can have immediate success learning the guitar and the fiddle. And after been doing it 5 years in Cordova, we felt that every town should have a music camp. And better than me telling you how great, listen to the kids play. And so we got six of the counselors together, and it was like an incredible success. They were together for 14 years. My son was with them, I think, for 10 and a half years. But five of the original six members stayed together for 9 years. And not only did they travel the U.S. and Canada and Europe, but they started doing camps. Kate Hamry, one of the bass player, has incredible organization skills. And so far she's done like over 100 camps, several of them in Juneau. There's going to be one in Petersburg in a week or so, a couple weeks.
My daughter took advantage of one of your camps a number of years ago and brought the mandolin home and serenaded our receptionist at the front desk at the station here.
Wow. Wow.
How are the camps? Go ahead.
Pardon me?
Go ahead.
So anyway, this program is phenomenal. And, just because the kids love it so much. And so we're coming to Juneau next week and doing a two-day camp, two afternoons. It's from 1 to 5 at Holy Trinity Church at McPheeters Hall. And kids will get a songbook. There'll be instruments to use. And, we want to show – it's a fundraiser for our village program. We'd really like to get it started in Southeast Alaska as well as Interior Alaska. And the program really has been funded to this point by schools and tribal organizations. We've had occasional grants. But it takes a lot of money to run something like this. And so we're inviting the community, too, to come in the evening, and we'll have a square dance, a potluck dinner at 5:30, and then the square dance and sing-along from 6:30 to 8 on Tuesday night. And then on Wednesday night, you won't believe it, but these kids will be able to play. It's for ages 6 to 17, and they'll do a little concert, and we'll have a square dance, and we're also having a silent auction. I brought, or will be bringing with me, a bunch of interior Alaska beadwork, barrettes and, earrings and a cell phone case with hummingbird on it. It's pretty spectacular stuff. And we want to try to not only show you how great this program is, because we can do it with your kids, but also raise money to go to villages in the interior as well as Southeast Alaska.
The camps are going to be here in Juneau, Tuesday and Wednesday, July 29th and 30th, from 1 to 5 p.m. They learn fiddle, guitar, mandolin, ukulele, and singing for ages 6 to 17. How do you organize a day?
Well, basically, when the kids come, they will be doing a sing-along, a jam, registration, have an instrument, put instruments in kids' hands immediately. And we use this color-coded system. And we use color dots, and so, for instance, the G chord is always red, and we even have this for fiddle tab, so that kids don't have to learn to read music. They may want to later, but they can just start off and be playing You Are My Sunshine, and, it's really pretty amazing.
So the kids don't have to have a lot of experience?
No, they can be beginners. We hope we can work with some of the advanced students, too, that are in Juneau. And it's a pay-as-you-go fundraiser. So basically, families can pay what they can. They can bring a dish to the potluck dinner. Whatever. I think it's an incredible gift to get kids involved in music. And I think it holds families together. If you're raising younger kids and you're worried about teenagers, I would say get them into music, because it's a lifetime sport. And it's so powerful, because it'll keep them happy all through school and in the rest of their lives.
I'm talking with Bill Mickelson, who's one of the organizers of the Youth Fiddle and Guitar Camp, which is happening next Tuesday and Wednesday. Bill, you just do amazing things. What keeps you going?
Well, I don't know. I guess being in a physical priest, I would say God. But, it's just... I have lots of fun friends and you know, I think it's wonderful to know that you can get high on music and love and laughter and, you know, bring this joy to other people.
I know you had a Kickstarter campaign going. Is it still going?
No, but we did have a Kickstarter campaign. One of the former Barefoot members, actually, she and her husband, Angelo Dean and Todd Grebe, put together a Kickstarter campaign to raise money for a Yukon River culture camp in Eagle, Alaska. And so we were up there, and we had the Reverend Trimble Gilbert from Arctic Village and his wife, Mary, and we had a couple from Toke that taught beadwork and scraping moose skins, and then Josephine Malamute, who's from the Koyukon region. And we all were playing lots of music and singing, and it was totally fun. And I really want to thank everybody that donated to that program because, anyway, it's really, I think it's wonderful for kids sharing with other kids. And I know one of the things that impressed me the most is one of the kids from Eagle, this was several years ago, and he wrote us a thank you note at the end of the week and put a $20 bill in there. And he said, I want to give this so you can go to other places. And I think, anyway, it's an amazing thing that hopefully teaches generosity and kindness and getting along. You know, when you, all the kids will get, that come to this camp, they'll get to take two classes and be in a band. And, you know, what a wonderful way to get to know other people in Juneau, other kids, and to work together in a really positive manner as being in a band. And then to perform and have everybody cheer for you. And I think one of my most favorite things, too, is to watch out in the audience and watch the parents and aunts and uncles just watching their little one just shining like a star.
Bill, if people need more information on your program, how do they get that?
Well, they can, we have a website. It's www.dancingwiththespirit.org. And you can call Holy Trinity. There's registration forms at 586-3532. They're open from 1 to 5 on weekdays. And also you could give me a call. My phone number is 907-388-3347.
Bill, I really appreciate the things you do for the state and for the communities that you're teaching in. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No, I appreciate what you do, Jeff. And, yeah, it's called Dancing with the Spirit. It's Tuesday and Wednesday next week, afternoons 1 to 5 at Holy Trinity Church at McPheeters Hall, and for kids 6 to 17. And if you have instruments you can loan us, that would be great. And I guess we'll look forward to seeing you next week. And don't forget, there's a silent auction on Wednesday night, as well as potluck dinners and square dances both nights. The dinner's at 5:30, and then the square dance and silent auction is 6:30 to 8.
Bill, thank you very much for being on the air with me today. That phone number for locals to call is 586-3532, or if you want to call Bill, her phone number is 907-388-3347. Bill, thanks again for being on the air with me today.
Hey, Jeff, this was awesome.
Beck with Bluegrass Band. Time is 3:21 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. I'm Jeff Brown, and our next guest in the studio with us is Jim Simard from the Alaska Historical Library. Jim, thank you for coming down.
Hello, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you're here to talk about photographer Seiki Kayamori, who's got an exhibit at the, outside the state office, outside the state historical library.
Yes, the collections has been actually at the library for quite a long time. It was in 1976, I think, that Byron Malott facilitated the donation of these glass plates that have been discovered in Yakutat.
First, before we get started too far, tell me about the Alaska Historical Library, please.
Well, the Historical Library, we're a part of the Libraries, Archives, and Museums, which is a function of the Department of Education. We collect personal papers and photograph collections, as well as published material about anything about the history of Alaska.
How do you keep all that stuff together?
Organization, man.
So, who was Seiki Kayamori?
He was a Japanese immigrant, born, I think, in 1877. He came to the west coast of America, like many men did at that time, to work. He did cannery work and any kind of work he could find. And he made his way to Yakutat in the summer of 1912. And unlike most of the workers who come up to do contract work in the canneries, he stayed on. He apparently had found his home there and felt comfortable and stayed there the rest of his life.
What are the photographs like? I guess it's over 700 photographs.
There are, and they're what I think it was a really very intimate overall community portrait. He regularly took pictures of events, A and B happenings, funerals, kuiks, weddings. So he was clearly being invited to come and document these events. But also, I think my favorite part of the collection are just his personal or small group portraits. People often come up to his house. Many of the pictures that he took were right on his porch, apparently faced the sun, and they're beautiful, very casual portraits of people.
Why the renewed interest?
Well, the collection, as I say, was in 76 when it first came to the State Library, and it was copied. Contact prints were made, two sets, one that was over in the City Hall in Yakutat and one that was in the State Library. So really the only access was physical access to look at one or the other of those two sets of prints. And, of course, now we have the ability to make digital copies and put things on the Internet. And slowly we've been doing that with the Kayamori over the last several years. But during this last year, the State Library had made a commitment. Largely it was because of other interests coming from researchers. But we, Damon Stubner, who does the photographic work at the State Library, did very careful, beautiful scans of each of these glass plates. And I should mention, a lot of them are actually on nitrate film. The bulk of the collection is glass. Many of them are on nitrate film stock. So we've imaged all of those. They're very good images are available, and we have put all of them onto the Alaska's Digital Archives, where they can be found by the general public and searched. But again, as I say, a lot of that was in response to some other interests by, many people, but in particular a couple of researchers. Margaret Thomas has just finished a new book about Kayamori. She has, by the way, a very interesting article that she published in the 1995 Alaska magazine, which is on the digital archives. If you go and you can find those photographs online, you'll also find her article, which I find fascinating. Another researcher who's been looking into Kayamori is Juliana Pegues, who's just finished her PhD, and a portion of her doctoral dissertation is about Kayamori. Her interest is in Asian immigration to Alaska and the relationships between Asian immigrants and Alaska Native communities. And she found Kayamori to be a really important example of that, and a way to kind of look at both of those communities together.
I should say that my interest was drawn by the article that Amy Fletcher wrote in The Empire, so thanks to Amy for calling our attention to that.
Thank you indeed. It's a beautiful article.
What was the state of the art of photography like back then?
Well, Guy Mori had, what I can tell looking at the negatives, at least two and maybe more cameras. And his newer cameras, to say the later photographs, were taken with a camera that used a smaller plate. Photography was then fairly well developed. The negatives that he was shooting onto were commercially available glass, as I say, subnitrate film. So they weren't, they were a dry plate process. He'd expose the plates. They were slow exposures, fairly slow film. They needed to have good light source, but most of the images, or many of them, are outdoors. The images he was capturing were very good, on the order of what good digital cameras are doing now. So if we were able to do good digital imaging of the negatives, then we get excellent detail in the photographs, and they're beautiful. Besides, this man was he was a cannery worker, but he was a can do kind of guy. He had he was a hunter, and one of the things that's I think kind of telling about him is if you look through his photographs in the online collection, he had several of them they took inside his own house. And I think just for the fun of doing it, but he seemed to have carefully arranged, his radio and his binoculars and his pistol hanging on the wall. His rifles are there. He's a guy who knew how to do things, and so he got interested in photography, and he did it quite well.
What size are we talking about as far as these glass plates?
I think they're in the order of 3x5.
And tragically, the photographer committed suicide in his own life, and that was a tragic end to this story.
It was, and it was a couple of days after Pearl Harbor. It was a highly charged time. There was a military base there in Yakutat, and from my readings, my understanding is that there was an FBI file on him for a long time, that he was a person of interest. And so he, rather than allow himself to be arrested, he took his own life.
What do you think makes these pictures important?
To me, the thing that makes them important is, the thing that's the most obvious to me is that the people in the community of Yakutat treasure them. Some of the people in the pictures are still living, they really are a record of that time, but a record made from a friend. So they're very personal, and I know that people have a personal connection to them.
How can people see these photographs?
Alaska's Digital Archives has the whole collection. That the web address is vilda.alaska.edu.
Who's Vilda?
Vilda is the virtual library and digital archives. We sometimes refer to her as our old Aunt Vilda.
Now you have not only the photographer's collection, but you have thousands more online.
I think there are over 80,000 objects up in there now. That the Digital Archives is a collaboration between the State Library and the university libraries in Anchorage and Fairbanks. And then there are another number of other contributing organizations. The newest of them is the Petersburg Public Library. It's got a nice little collection started. It's a very valuable collection of materials, fun just to browse through. It's mostly photographs, but not exclusively. There are motion pictures online that we've been adding. Cyril Goodwin, a librarian at the Historical Library, has been using a platform called SchoolTube, and those are all linked back right through the digital archives. It's a wonderful collection of motion pictures there.
I'm talking with Jim Smart from the Alaska Historical Library about the photographer Seki Kayamori. If you'd like to see his photos, you can go to the Historical Library itself, and right outside there's a viewing There's how many images, 8 or 10?
There's a small collection there, and there what you see, we have a couple of cases outside of the our front door, the historical library. Those are some of the contact prints that were made in the 70s. But we've also put up a virtual exhibit there where we've got a large screen and rotating some of these TIFF images, which are really worth looking at. They're beautiful in that that kind of format. They're very pretty to see. And so stop by the library. One thing I wanted to mention is that we're on the atrium on the 8th floor of the State Office Building. Right across the atrium, in the Information Services window, there's another large screen that will be carrying some more of these photographs. It's a flat screen version of the Science on a Sphere that has been over at the State Museum, which of course is down now. Sarah Lee is a person on the staff that maintains that. She has a lot of science programs running right now. There's one running about earthquakes in Alaska in real time, and has some information about the one we had last night. It's worth looking at.
Well, it knocked out my internet connection.
That's right.
It seems smart. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
I just wanted to mention one thing. The whole division, libraries, archives, and museums, is of course moving into our new building next door to the radio station here. The entire museum collection has been moved into the new storage area in preparation for demolition of the old museum. The archive staff is working right now on bringing all of the archives records from offsite storage. They're bringing those into the building. But just today was a big event that Dean Dawson, the state archivist, signed for responsibility for 3,000 cubic feet of materials that have come down from the NARA, the National Archives facility in Anchorage. There's been a lot of press about that they're closing that facility. And so what's going to be housed permanently here in Juneau as part of our new building are the Alaska Railroad records and significantly the territorial court records. So I think it's a very big deal for Alaskan researchers to have access to those things. And those will all be, access will be provided through a single reading room with the historical library in the new building.
Now, I listened to the news this morning, and I guess people asking for information about territorial days is just staggering.
Absolutely. It is.
Jim, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, Jeff.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 25th of July, 2014. 1897, on this date, Jack London set off for the Klondike Gold Rush, along with 100,000 other men. He was 21 years old. He went with his brother-in-law up to the Yukon, got sick up there, developed scurvy, didn't make any money, but he was inspired by what he saw. He lived in Dawson City in a house owned by mining engineers who'd gone to Yale and Stanford. And he realized how poor his own education was, and he decided to get one and become a writer. He headed back the next summer, back to California, threw himself into writing, wrote a short story set in the dead of the Yukon winter. It was accepted by a magazine, and then more short stories about the Yukon gold rush. And in 1903, he wrote his novel about a dog named Buck, The Call of the Wild, and it made Jack London suddenly famous. It was on this day 200 years ago, 1814, Northern England, George Stephenson made the first successful demonstration of the steam locomotive. It pulled 8 wagons, 30 tons worth, about 4 miles an hour, up a hill. The locomotive was invented in England, but it had a greater impact in this country, where there was so much more wide-open space. And by 1840, the United States had 2,800 miles of railroad track. By 1872, 52,000. It was on this day, 1788, that Mozart entered into his catalog the completion of one of his most famous works, the Symphony No. 40 in G minor, sometimes called the Great G Minor Symphony. An infant daughter had died a few weeks before. The family had moved into a cheaper apartment. He was trying to get loans from his friends. But in that summer of 1788, he wrote his last three symphonies, 39 in E-flat, the G minor, and the Jupiter Symphony. It's not known for sure if he ever heard any of these symphonies performed. And it's the birthday of the saxophonist Johnny Hodges, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 1906, joined Duke Ellington in 1928, and was a mainstay of the ensemble until he died in 1970. Johnny Hodges' nickname was Rabbit. He got it from his love of lettuce and tomato sandwiches. Here's a poem for today by Terry Kirby Erickson, Ice Cream Truck. From blocks away, we heard the mechanical music. The ice cream truck chimed all over the neighborhood, calling to kids like the Pied Piper, as we darted into our houses, begging our parents for change to buy Nutty Buddies and banana popsicles, orange push-ups, and ice cream sandwiches. Once the truck stopped on our street, we swooped like seagulls around the open window so the ice cream man could take our money and hand out whatever treats we asked for, which were always better than we remembered from the last time his boxy, hand-painted truck rolled around, the cold, creamy confections freezing our tongues and sliding down our parched throats as fast as we could eat them, the taste of summer lingering just long enough to make us wish for more. Ice Cream Truck by Terry Kirby Erickson, from A Lake of Light and Clouds, published by Press 53 and used by permission here in the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to, thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org, and by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Produced by Joy Biles, assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time is 3:39, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Now it's time for some live music.
I've got a box of letters to send to you, with words explaining why I left you crumpled and blue. They sit in the darkest corner of my room, waiting for the day when I tear my wall down brick by brick. Brick by brick. Brick by brick. Brick by brick. Down, drown me now. Pour that whiskey down my throat. Take me now. I want your hands all over mine, as I have lost it all. To the shadows behind my eyes, you are nothing more than the lies to hide my scars. Now where are we? We are lost in the woods again. Now
where now, where are we? We are lost in the woods again. Running, falling, climb my way, trying to find my way out. Screaming, dying, wasting away, trying to find my way out. Out of the woods, out of the woods, out of the woods, out of the woods. Lost in the woods again. Now where now, where are we? We are lost in the woods again. Running, falling, climb my way, trying to find my way out. Screaming, dying, wasting away, trying to find my way out. Out of the woods, out of the woods, out of the woods, out of the woods. Catching his eye, touching my soul, caught in a whirlpool of truth and light. Catching his eye, touching my soul, caught in a whirlpool of truth and light. Waiting, starving, the pain of my soul, right outside my door, waiting for you to tear my world down, brick by brick. The waiting, stubborn, the pain on my soul, right outside my door, waiting for you to tear my world down, brick by brick. Oh. I'm searching for a way out of the woods.
It was phenomenal. That was Sabie H. Flores, who is going to be appearing tonight as part of the Food Truck Friday performance at the Juno Arts and Culture Center. Thank you for the music.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you're from Fairbanks.
Yes, I am. Born and raised.
What made you pick up the cello?
Well, I was four, so... my mom chose it for me. I guess she asked me when I was four, but I don't remember that.
I looked at your website. I mention your website so people can check it out themselves.
Yeah, www.sabieflores.com. Sabie is S-A-B-E.
You had an interesting childhood.
Yeah, it's been a good one. Yeah, my dad died when I was one, and his dream for me was to play music, so... When I was four, my mom started me on the cello because that's her favorite instrument. And I started playing classical music with the Suzuki method. And that was great. I learned a lot. I had some great teachers. And I started, when I was 13, I started studying at the university with Mina Chung and another cellist, Donnie Oliver. And my first cello teacher was Peggy Schwartz. and she taught me a lot. And when I was 10th grade of high school, I decided that I needed to leave Fairbanks. And I had gotten really sick. I had gotten mono, and just kind of my life was falling apart. I was sick for six months, and after that, I was like, I need to get out of Alaska for a second. So I went down to California to Idlewild Arts Academy, and I studied with this amazing cellist, John Waltz. And he was very good at teaching concertos, so it's obviously very classical. And I was very inspired, but also I realized that I'm just not meant for the classical world, you know. It takes a certain person, and I'm just not that person.
Tell me about your creative process.
My creative process? Well, it's been changing. It changes. Like, at first, I play guitar, and so I just was kind of, like, trying to rebel. And, you know, basically playing with whoever I could play with, and that's why I was kind of finding inspiration from not people who play the cello or not really any kind of, you know, no violins or violas. That was not my inspiration. My inspiration was from the rock and rollers and, you know, blues artists. And so I just started jamming out with people and, like, trying to, you know, find something that made me happy musically. And now my creative process is I'm very inspired by people and their stories and traveling. And I wasn't a good classical musician in the sense that I don't like being stuck in a practice room. I mean, I enjoy that sometimes. It's a sort of meditation, but I really do enjoy interacting with people that I might not otherwise. Or, you know, everybody has a story, and it's fun for me to try to incorporate that into my lyrics. I'm very inspired by people.
You're performing tonight at 6 o'clock at the Juno Arts and Culture Center.
Yes, sir.
What can we expect tonight?
Well, I always kind of base it off my crowd, so might get kind of dancey here, or if it's more mellow, play more of my, you know, tunes about life. I don't really know. I just base it off the crowd. Last night I played the Alaskan, and I had more of a dancey set there, so that was awesome. I love to get people dancing. I feel like if you're a cellist and you're singing, and to get people up there dancing is like my ultimate goal, and it feels so awesome.
Sadie, thank you very much for coming by the station today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, won't you answer? me, you don't know me. Judge not that ye be not judged. That's what the Bible told me. Boxed in cause they told me it would make me less lonely. They say I'm crazy, but I'm just missing my lady. God took everything from me, even my sanity. Suicide on my mind, Bible held to my side. Forgiven, ye shall be forgiven. Living like this born sinners. Cold soul in this cold road. Cold soul on this cold road.
I am old, I walk alone, but I'm free. Yeah. Free to believe what I see in my mind at night. Yeah.
Music of Sadie Flores. She is appearing tonight at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center as part of Food Talk Friday. I have another performer in the studio, Carl Reese, who's going to be performing this as well at the Jack Next Door tonight. Carl, some music, please. Thank you very much for displaying the studio with us today.
Sure, thanks.
You're performing tonight at the Jack as part of Food Truck Friday. It says in the program is with cluttered rooms. Can you describe what cluttered rooms is?
Oh, well, it's just an idea that I had that, you know, I play different kinds of music at various times, and cluttered rooms is just me and other people that I might play with, but it's mainly my musical vehicle at the time. And it is kind of built on the idea of just a collection of thoughts that seem to make their way, that sort of aren't very jumbled, sort of like a messed up room, that might make their way into music a lot more clearly than they otherwise would. For me, I express myself better in music than in other ways sometimes.
Cool. What are your inspirations?
They vary a lot. You know, I mean, musically, you know, well, in some cases, I might have inspirations musically that aren't really musicians, like, I don't know, authors like Wendell Berry or Barbara Kingsolver. But I think my musical inspirations would be more like Neil Young or Nirvana. Or there's a new person named Ben Howard I really like. You know, there's a lot of people. It varies actually from day to day.
Tell me about your creative process.
It actually just often involves kind of a two-part kind of thing. I mean, I do an awful lot of just walking and hiking, and just thoughts come to my head, and sometimes even songs come into my head, and I'll sing. If you know, you might catch me out on the mountain just kind of humming to myself or even singing out loud, and you'll probably think I'm crazy, and you might be right. But then it all seems to come together a lot with just playing the guitar in the living room. That's where it usually comes, kind of forms, even though some of the better ideas might happen when I'm not there. I just take them there and kind of put things together and kind of make it a little more sensible.
What time are you playing tonight?
6:30.
All right, at the Jack, and that's absolutely free as part of Food Truck Friday by the Juno Arts and Amenities Council. Carl, thanks again for coming by.
Sure, thanks.
This is Bird Note. Imagine visiting Mount Rainier National Park on a sunny summer day, or Yellowstone, or Mount Katahdin in Maine. You spread out sandwiches and chips on a picnic table and turn to grab a cold drink from the cooler when an uninvited guest arrives, the gray jay. Often called the Camp Robber or Whiskey Jack, the mountain-dwelling gray jay seems to crash a picnic even faster than hungry ants. The fluffy, long-tailed jay is sooty gray with a white collar and forehead. And it is bold! It first hops around in a nearby tree, and then, with soft, soundless flight, drops into the middle of your camp. The robber escapes with edible bits, which it stores by fastening in trees with its sticky saliva. The gray jay breeds across northern Canada and into Alaska, reclaiming its stored food in cold, snowy, seemingly foodless conditions. As for the nickname Whiskey Jack, it comes from the Athabascan Tlingit name for this species, Whiskajon. From this word, white settlers created Whiskey John, then shortened John to Jack. The bird became Whiskey Jack, nickname for the gray jay. You too can find some juicy tidbits when you visit us on the web at birdnote.org. And unlike the gray jay, you're always invited. I'm Michael Stein.
Four days of incredible entertainment at the Southeast Alaska State Fair, July 31st through August 3rd in Haines. Split Lip Rayfield. Elephant Revival. Vagabond Swing plays psycho gypsy jazz punk fusion, plus Skagway Aerial Company, Hot Toddies, and many more. Information and tickets at seakfair.org.
Time is 3:59. You are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. Coming up Monday on a Juneau afternoon, we'll talk with Rosemary Greening about and Allison Brown about Thursday's PEO Whale Watch fundraiser. We'll profile local artist Meredy Davis, and we'll get an update on Perseverance Theater's Summerfest at Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more next Monday on a Juneau afternoon.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K27.